I spent the first part of my career working in tropical systems, especially tropical forests, trying to understand how nitrogen cycles in those systems, how the forests interact with the atmosphere, and how land use changes, human activities, were affecting those systems. And in the early 1990s, I had an epiphany, suddenly, a sudden realization that, you know, I'd like to spend part of my career not just identifying problems, but helping find solutions. And I look around the room and realize you've all been doing this your entire career. And I came to it a little late, but but it has been, it was a shift in my thinking and in the way I do research. I moved, in a sense, from biogeochemistry focus to a sustainability science focus. And what I'd like to do today is talk about some of the research that I've done and that others that I've been associated with have done in trying to make that connection from biogeochemistry to sustainability. Now, since I'm using the term sustainability, I should define it. And of course, we all know there's lots of different definitions out there. In the corporate world, where a lot of work is going on right now, they talk about the triple bottom line, or the three E's for economy, environment, and equity. The definition that I use is one that we developed as part of a National Academy activity, the National Academy's Board on Sustainable Development. And it's a simple statement of goals, and it reads like this. We need to find ways to meet the needs of people today and in the future, and by that I mean our needs for food, energy, water, shelter, education, employment, and so on. And we also need to protect and sustain the life support systems of the planet. And by that I mean our atmosphere and water systems, our climate system, and the species and ecosystems on land and in the oceans that provide so many of the things that we need and that future generations are going to need in order to have their needs met. So it's a very simple, easy statement, but it is incredibly challenging when you think about that. So, on the social side, on the meeting the needs of people side, it is true that things have gotten better, and lifespans have increased, infant mortality rates are in decline around the world. More people have access to health care and to education than ever before, and yet there are still a billion adults, mostly women, who can't read. A couple of billion people without access to clean water, to sanitation, or to modern forms of energy. And almost a billion people go to bed hungry part of the time. And that's today. Human population is still growing. We're expecting to level off somewhere above 9 billion in the middle part of this century. And we have to worry about meeting those needs as well. It's also challenging on the other side of that equation, on the life support system side. And again, it's true that in some places around the world, we've gotten our act together. We've cleaned up water and atmosphere and so forth. And yet, we're changing the global atmosphere in amazing ways. What used to be local, you know, air pollution problems are now region-wide tides of smog. We've added a lot of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, mostly from fossil fuel burning, but also from land use activities. And we're changing climate. We're acidifying the oceans. 50% of the land's ice-free surface has been completely changed by human activities, with a whole cascade of other issues. And so, you know, the life support side has its challenges too. Part of the problem is that when we look at our past, progress towards those dual goals have often been in conflict with each other. We haven't been able to do one without damaging the other. And let's, you know, take energy, for example. Energy is a key ingredient to just about everything we do on the planet. Demand is increasing incredibly rapidly. If I showed to 210, it'd be off this chart. And we are supplying, we're meeting that energy demand mostly through the fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas. And, you know, there are some sustainability issues with access to them, but the real problem is that environmentally, the fossil fuels are the source of just about, you know, all the pollution we have on the planet in our soils, atmosphere, and water systems. And, of course, they're also the source, the main source of anthropogenic carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, which is driving climate change, which has all kinds of impacts on systems, ultimately creating huge risks for our ability to meet people's needs in the future for food and water and other things. If we think about food production, again, another essential effort to meet the needs of people, I think we would all agree that this is the success story of human history. We've been able to keep food production at pace with population growth over that very rapid increase in population in the latter half of the last century. And we've done that largely through Green Revolution technologies. As we go into the future, we have more to do. We have to double food production again, at least, in order to address the increasing population and consumption needs. Well, again, as we look to the past, that success in increasing food production carried a cost in terms of life support systems of the planet. Land conversions to agriculture, at least up until this point, have been the most important driver of biodiversity loss, and we're losing biodiversity at rates of 100 to 1,000 times background rates. It's also, because of the intensification of inputs in agriculture, had a whole set of consequences for our land and air and water systems. Fertilizer use, and in particular nitrogen use, is an area that I've worked a lot on, so I'm going to focus on here. If you take a look at that top line, you see the very amazing increase in global nitrogen fertilizer use on the planet, continuing to increase and expected to continue up through the middle of this century. Now, that has been really good because it's one of the reasons we've been able to increase food production, but it also carries some global consequences. Part of the problem is that nitrogen doesn't stay where it's supposed to be put. It moves around the planet. Now, and it's actually constitutes a global change. And I think the easiest way to get a sense of the global change in nitrogen because of fertilizer use is to look at it in the context of the natural nitrogen cycle. So in this graph, that middle range between 100 and 200 teragrams of nitrogen per year is the range of nitrogen that's added to the terrestrial system thanks to natural nitrogen fixation by microbes. Somewhere between 100 and 200 teragrams added. When you look then at fertilizer use, which is in the brown line, together with nitrogen fixation in agroecosystems in the green line, and the inadvertent fixation of nitrogen by fossil fuels in the purple line at the bottom, and you add those up, you see that we have actually more than doubled the availability of nitrogen in the global system. And it's happened incredibly recently, in just the last, half century or so. So, the question is, so what? Well, part of the problem, of course, is that nitrogen is a very mobile element. It cascades, it hopscotches around the planet and has a number of different environmental consequences. Some of it moves in gaseous forms as ammonia or NOx, NO and NO2. From both fossil fuel combustion and emissions from soils, fertilized soils especially. And that nitrogen is reactive in the atmosphere, it affects air quality, and it gets deposited downwind onto whatever happens to be downwind. And in some cases, it's inadvertently fertilizing natural systems with consequences for their biodiversity, for their composition, and for their functioning. And nitrogen deposition is a global phenomenon. It's a global environmental change. Fertilization is also the major source of the greenhouse gas nitrous oxide. I spent the early part of my career trying to figure out why nitrous oxide was increasing, and it's pretty clearly largely because of the use of fertilizers. And nitrous oxide is a very, very potent greenhouse gas, and it's contributing to the increase in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and climate change. And then, of course, fertilizer use has consequences for soil quality and also affects downstream ecosystems. The movement of nitrogen through watersheds to the coastal regions is leading to eutrophication of coastal waters in many parts of the world. It's the main reason we have this region-wide, very large area of hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico that seems to grow every year. And again, this is a global phenomenon. It's happening all around the world. It's global in extent and effect. So when we add it up, fertilizer use in agriculture and agriculture in general, the critical thing we're doing to meet the needs of people is having inadvertently a whole bunch of environmental consequences, a whole bunch of stresses on the life support systems of the planet. So our challenge then as we go forward is to figure out how to do these things together rather than in conflict with each other. How do we meet the needs of people at the same time that we sustain the life support systems of the planet so that future generations can have their needs met? And that is the area that I think we all need to be working today. Well, it's going to be a hard transition to get to that point, and I think we have to think about baby steps, one step at a time. But let's think about what a transition to sustainability will take. And I'm looking at this now from an academic point of view, from a university's point of view. There's a lot we can do to help. We can develop new and more integrative knowledge, tools, and approaches that allow us to produce food without environmental consequences. We need to take improved actions to link that knowledge to action on the ground, to decision making. We, of course, have a role in educating the leaders of the future who can use this information. But there are going to be a lot of other things that are required, and probably most importantly, leadership. But for today's comments, I'm going to focus just on those top two items. And I'm going to draw briefly on work that I've done in with many others in an area called the Yaqui Valley in Sonora, Mexico. This is about 250,000 hectares of irrigated wheat in the middle of the Sonoran Desert, bounded to the west by the Sea of Cortez, or the Gulf of California, one of the world's biodiversity hotspots. Every conservation organization in the world works there because it's such an important place. I started working in the Yaqui Valley in the 1990s, and as part of an interdisciplinary team, my key collaborators are Roz Naylor, who's an agricultural economist from Stanford. She leads the Food Security and Environment Program at Stanford. Ivan Ortiz-Monasterio, who is an agronomist, U.S.-trained agronomist from CIMMYT, the International Maize and Wheat Research Institute, that, by the way, has it's one of its main research sites there in that irrigated agricultural area of the Yaqui Valley. And then many others, hydrologists, political scientists, geographers, and on, participated in this work. The Yaqui Valley is an interesting place to work because it is actually the home of the Green Revolution for wheat. It's where Norman Borlaug and his colleagues carried out the early work that led to the development of high-yielding wheat varieties that were then spread around the developing world as part of the Green Revolution. And so it's an exciting place to work for that reason. But it's an interesting place to work as well because the farmers of the Yaqui Valley have been very successful. You can see the green line on the top of that graph shows their success with increasing yields over time. And they've been successful in part because they've had access to, immediate access to all of those, the new varieties that are produced there at the CIMMYT Agricultural Field Station in the Yaqui Valley. Immediate access. Year after year, they're trying new things as needed. They've also been successful. That success is also based on the fact that Mexico heavily subsidized, heavily encouraged them to use inputs, including fertilizers. When they first started business there in the 50s, a small proportion, or not everybody, was using fertilizer on their lands, and they were actually using much less than even would have been required to optimize growth at that point. By 1981, you can see everybody's using fertilizers, and they're using about the right amounts. Agronomists would say that's about right for the yields they were getting then and today. But as you can see, their use continued to increase, application rates continued to increase, and that sets up one of the big challenges that this place is facing, that sort of use of fertilizer. The other reason they've been so successful is, of course, that they have lots of water, and there are huge reservoirs on very large watersheds that feed this area. Almost all the water goes to them, And they've been lucky because their reservoir stayed full over the last 50 years, despite the fact that they're in a region where, if we look at paleo data and historical data, droughts do reoccur every 50 to 100 years. So they've been lucky, or they were lucky until the end of the 1990s and early 2000s when they faced an extended drought, that they had no tools and knowledge base, basically no rules to prevent themselves from pumping their reservoirs dry. And basically they put themselves out of business for a couple of years because of drought. And that's a whole other issue that I won't get into, but one that became a major focus of our research there, looking for, you know, models and tools to help sustain the use of water. But I want to talk today about the fertilizer questions that we asked there. We basically asked generally, can these cropping systems be managed to maintain or even improve yields but reduce the environmental challenges associated with it? And in terms of the fertilizer use, we asked, so first of all, what are the biogeochemical processes and consequences of the way they use fertilizer here? How and why do farmers do what they do? And what alternatives are possible that could be good for agriculture, good for the farmers, good for profits and everything else, and also good for the environment? So in looking at fertilizer, use of fertilizer nitrogen in these systems, you know, we basically would expect a whole bunch of different processes to occur in these soils. The way farmers there mostly fertilized was by applying very large amounts of fertilizer, around 250 kilograms per hectare of nitrogen, applied 75% of it applied prior to planting, about a month prior to planting the seeds. And then they would irrigate, sprout the weeds, and be able to disk them under by the time they planted. Well, given that approach, we would predict, and did predict, very large losses through a number of different pathways. Add urea to dry soils, wet them up, rapidly hydrolyze to ammonium. In these soils, which are quite alkaline, we have a pH-dependent equilibrium between ammonia and ammonium, and a lot of it goes off as ammonia gas. Some of the ammonium, maybe 15% of what's applied regionally, goes off in till water, doesn't even get into the agricultural system. But once you've got ammonium in the soil, lots of other things can happen to it. It is nitrified in aerobic conditions by bacteria to nitrate, and in that process, going off as gases, you have NO, nitric oxide, which is a precursor to smog. It's a precursor to acid rain. And you have nitrous oxide, that greenhouse gas that I spoke about before. Once you have nitrate in the soil, you can have leaching very easily as water moves through the soil profile. You can have it denitrified to nitrous oxide or to dinitrogen gas. So a whole range of things we would expect to have happen. We went out and actually measured them and found that, in fact, we were seeing major losses through all of these different pathways. Here's just a tiny bit of the data. This is nitrous oxide and nitric oxide emissions. In two different years, we carried out research on the experiment station and in farmers' fields. These numbers don't mean anything to you, so I will just say these are the highest fluxes of these gases ever measured. Huge amounts coming out in that period between when the fertilizer is applied before the crops are planted. We had an intellectual interest in what was causing those emissions, and using N15 studies, isotope tracer studies, we found that at least half of the trace gas emissions were coming from nitrification versus denitrification. That actually is an important thing to know if you're trying to manage to reduce losses, but it was actually sort of an intellectually fun sideline for this. We also measured leaching losses at a meter depth in the soil and found that between 20 and 50 kilograms per hectare of nitrogen was being lost from the crop that way just during the growing season, and probably more lost during off season. Now, where does that nitrogen go? Well, there's a network of canals, some of them man-made, some of them natural, that drain from the agricultural district right out into the Sea of Cortez. And we studied what happened in those systems and found very large, very high trace gas emissions from these, but also lots of really interesting biogeochemistry. Again, from a pure biogeochemist point of view, this has been really an interesting place to study. Nonetheless, a lot of the nitrogen that's moving through them makes its way out into the estuaries of the Sea of Cortez. And in those systems, again, we studied to find out what happens to that nitrogen and found that through a couple of different approaches, estimated that between 15 and 30% of the nitrogen that gets into them doesn't end there, basically, doesn't get denitrified there. It moves, only 15% gets denitrified there. The rest of it moves out into the Sea of Cortez, out into the basically the open ocean there. And then we asked the question, what happens to it out there in the Gulf of California? And we carried out an interesting remote sensing analysis to try to get a handle on that, where we collected information from CWIFs, one of the satellite sensors that gets at chlorophyll content, greenness index, basically, and using AVHRR to tell us something about water temperature. We traced what happens to the nitrogen over time, over a five-year period. And just to abbreviate this, I'll say basically, one of the things that could cause phytoplankton blooms, shown by the green areas under chlorophyll there, could be upwelling of cold water, cold nutrient-rich water, a natural force in this very rich Sea of Cortez. But we were able to subtract that out by using the very cold events measured in the sea surface temperature by the AVHRR satellite sensors. And when we subtract off the natural causes of phytoplankton blooms, the greenness there, we found that we were able to relate the blooms to irrigation and fertilization events on land, which are very synchronous and therefore very discrete. And something like 85% of the big irrigation times throughout this five-year period were associated with very, very large phytoplankton blooms in the ocean. Really the only study that's ever made that kind of close connection. Then we followed what happens to the phytoplankton blooms in the Sea of Cortez, and these are huge, like 50 to 500 square kilometer blooms. And they were swirled basically across the Sea of Cortez over into the area next to Baja California, where all of the marine protected areas are. We don't know what the consequences are, but we know it's making its way around that system. So we actually, over a number of years, got a very good understanding of where the nitrogen that is lost from the agricultural systems is going, and realized that there are some serious consequences of those losses. So then we were at the same time asking, why are farmers doing what they're doing here? Why are they applying all that fertilizer and ahead of time? And we carried out a whole series of surveys, interviews, and working with CIMMYT, got great long-time databases on these questions. And in the late 90s, they were doing it because up until recently, fertilizer had been very cheap. These are what farmers said. At the time, you know, by the late 1990s, they had become the number one cost of the farm budget. But just 5 years before that, they'd been very cheap. So I think there was still an adjustment period there. They noted labor and machinery constraints, but in fact, some of the more progressive farmers seem to overcome those quite easily. They noted concern about climate variability. You know, year to year, it could be very different. They want to get as much on as they can make sure they have enough to optimize yields. And experience tells them that it's worked, basically, over time. So then we asked the question, are there different ways of doing business that would still work for the farmers and for the environment? And we did this through a series of field experiments and also through a number of simulations, and I'll tell you a little bit about each of those. On the field experiment side, we tried a whole bunch of different alternatives. Now, one interesting thing when you bring, you know, ecologists and biogeochemists and agronomists and economists all together around this, you get into a debate about what kind of experiments to actually do. And we ended up doing different things than any one of us would have done alone because we were trying, you know, to keep this question about what makes sense for the farmers and the environment. Among all of our alternatives, we found a number that would dramatically decrease the loss of nitrogen from the agricultural systems for example, applying most of the nitrogen either at planting or a month after planting, obviously when there's a crop on the ground to use it, dramatically reduces emissions to the atmosphere and to groundwater. Maintains yields, probably in many cases increases yield quality, and saved a lot of money. In fact, the economic analyses suggest could save 12 to 18% of after-tax profits for the farmers if they were to switch to this best alternative. And there the gases are shown in green. So we also then carried out a set of simulations using a model called WINM, the Water and Nitrogen Management Model of our good friend Deli Cheng from Australia. And we added a little bit, modified it for our site, tested it against observations. And from the use of that model at the regional scale, we again confirmed that best management practice, very much like the one we developed on in the experimental studies, could dramatically increase nitrogen use efficiency and decrease losses and increase profit. And even better yet, if we could do site-specific management, where we take into consideration the variation in soils and year-to-year climate variation and management, we could do even better. So the bottom line is, you know, we can reduce inputs, we can reduce losses, we can maintain yields, and we can save money. It's a no-brainer, right? Yes, this is going to work. So we then went, as I think we all would, working with farmers, doing on-farm trials, doing field days, doing farmer workshops, and hoped that we would see a change. And then we made the unfortunate mistake of checking to see whether the change was occurring. And we found that it wasn't, that fertilizer use was actually continuing to increase. We asked then the question why. Clearly we were missing something. So we stepped back and did an analysis of what I call a knowledge system, the knowledge system, the institutions, organizations, individuals that share information, create information, and integrate information for decision making in this valley or in any place. And when we went into the study, I think this is what we thought the knowledge system was like. There's CIMMYT, the International Maize and Wheat Research Institute, with the national centers, connected with us and other people in universities, most importantly, connected directly with innovative farmers who were trying out the things we were suggesting in on-farm trials. We thought that was the knowledge system of the Yaqui Valley. When we actually studied it, we found that it looks something like this, that there are many more players that have influence, and most critically, there in the middle, we found that the role of credit unions is enormously important. Credit unions here are really farmer associations that provide credit, advice, access to markets. They're very critical, very credible organizations that the farmers belong to. And they have a lot of control, especially by the 2000s when there are very few extension agents left in Mexico. So, what drives fertilizer decisions? Well, it's credit union advice, but both the credit unions and the farmers were really responding to uncertainty. They're worried about year-to-year variability in climate. They want to make sure they're going to do well under the best years. The credit unions are worried that there's a range of soils, there's a range of managers. They want to just optimize it for everybody. And so they basically said, with strings attached, apply all the nitrogen you can possibly apply. And of course, there is an economic incentive for them to say that too, since they're providing the credit for buying the fertilizer. Anyway, so realizing that, we developed Yvonne Ortiz Monasterio, really, with other colleagues, developed a new set of studies using real-time information about nutrient requirements in these crops using a handheld radiometer system. It's called GreenSeeker, now used quite broadly. It's in a sense a low-tech kind of precision agriculture. And most importantly, we didn't just work with the farmers to do this, we worked with the credit unions and involved them in the research, eventually got them to buy the Green Seekers for their associations, and now this is extremely widely used in the Yaqui Valley. So there's a lot of other stories to tell about the Yaqui Valley that I won't tell. I want to stick with the nitrogen story for a little while, and then ask the question, if we look around the rest of the world, is this story anything like what's happening in other places? And the answer is, there's actually a huge range of nitrogen management, nitrogen additions around the planet. In some places, and here's an example from Kenya, but this is true for many of the African countries, there is not enough nitrogen applied. They are operating in a deficit and driving down their soil resources over time. And their subsidies to increase fertilizer use is probably, you know, still a good idea. But in other parts of the world, and here look at North China as an example, we've gone over the edge. We are now applying nitrogen far in excess of crop requirements, much as I showed in the Yaqui Valley, much as Europe and the United States used to be. And in the case of North China, the fantastic group of agricultural researchers there has caught on, has realized they've got a problem. Work by Fuso Zhang and many other researchers at the Chinese Agricultural University has made inroads into the question of how to reduce the inputs and reduce the environmental consequences of agriculture. I wanted to say here, it's actually, this is an important place to be working because this is where all the action is with fertilizer increases right now. China and India are responsible for the major increases in use that we've seen worldwide since 2000. Lots going on there. And so a good place to ask the question, can we ratchet this back? Can we maintain yields and reduce the environmental consequences of agriculture? And their excellent work, you know, they did much like we did, only 20 times better, showed basically the same thing. You can reduce the inputs you see farmer practice on the left and optimum practice on the right. You can easily reduce inputs and reduce outputs and therefore environmental consequences by using practices that apply nitrogen more carefully timed to crop requirements. And you can maintain yields in doing that. So that's a really good story. But the problem in China is that they don't want to just maintain yields. That's where population is still growing. They have very low per capita grain production still. And their yields have sort of plateaued, have leveled off over the last 10 years or so. So they need, and they will tell you this, and my colleagues have told me this, they need to increase yields, but they also need to decrease the environmental consequences. They need to do it at the same time. And so a group, again, from the Chinese Agricultural University have been using agroecological approaches to try to do that, using the same kinds of cropping systems that are in place right now. And they use integrated soil crop system management to get there. For example, they use simulation models of both the crop system and the soil system, models that actually help them try to maximize or optimize the planting variety, the planting date, the planting density, given a particular area's soil and climate conditions, and also maximize the lower part, how nitrogen is managed in these systems. And they do this, they've done this for different areas of the country. They've basically designed a high-yielding, low-environmentally degrading system, and then they've gone out and done it in a whole bunch of different places around the northern part of the country. And the results are quite interesting. This is a hard table to read, so I'll just put a couple circles there. Their integrated systems studies are shown to the right, comparing on the far left with the farmers' practices from just measurements done all over the country. And you can see that using their integrated systems management, they were able to double yields, but not even change the amount of fertilizer that's required. And so that's a really pretty good story. They also compared that to their highest yielding studies, and that's the middle set, where they're in the highest yielding areas, they're getting 15.2 tons per hectare yield. But you can see the difference in the amount of fertilizer that's required to get that yield. 747 kilograms per hectare in the high yielding studies, only 237 in the integrated system studies. So this works, and they've done it in so many places that it does work. Now the really big question is, how in the world do you implement it? And here's a problem that's a knowledge system problem. In China, in the North China Plain, most of the agricultural fields are tiny, 0.1 hectare. You know, hundreds of thousands of farmers farm small pieces of land. And how do you take information and knowledge-intensive practices and apply them in these areas? My Chinese colleagues have some ideas. I'm really interested in this in terms of my own research. But it's clearly the next step. You can have all the great technologies in the world, but if you can't get people to apply them, it's not going to help. So these two examples from China and from the Yaqui Valley, I think, suggest to us that, at least in some of these rapidly developing economies, integrated systems approaches may be just as important as new efforts in plant breeding technologies and precision agriculture, high-tech precision agriculture. In every, you know, in science and nature and every place else you look, you see this list, you know, the breeding and the precision agriculture as the solutions for the future. But we would suggest we need to invest more in management, in integrated management systems that pay attention both to yields and to nutrient management. And there's a lot of, unfortunately, in many parts of the world, the investments in those kinds of research efforts have basically gone away. So let me return to my original question, what will it take for a transition to sustainability? I do think that it's going to take more integrative approaches than we have been doing in the past. And the way I like to think about it is this. You know, for many years, I hate these terms, but we've divided in the world into basic and applied research, with the basic research just being about learning new things about how the world works, and applied really being focused on developing improved decision making. I think sustainability science is a combination of those two things. I think we have to draw on every discipline's knowledge. We have to do away with the idea that some are basic and some are applied. We need to do use-inspired fundamental research that both contributes to improved understanding and to improved technology, improved decision-making. And I think that the kinds of work that we carried out in the Yaqui Valley are an example of that. As Joe mentioned in his comments, we also need to focus much more intently on the interactions with decision-makers, whether they be corporations or producers or any other decision-maker, water resource managers or whoever else. Because without that dialogue, without that interaction, without that collaboration, we're likely to get the questions wrong. Obviously, a lot of other things are going to be needed in this transition to sustainability. It's going to take us moving step by step. The work that I talked about is not the solution. We're not there. They're tiny baby steps, in a sense, along a transition to sustainability. But we need to be moving, and that is going to take leadership. And I would say leadership by universities really matters in this, because we can encourage and incentivize the kind of integrative research that draws the expertise from all of our disciplines to work together. And with that, I will say thank you, and thanks to my funders. Thank you for listening. Thank you for inviting me to be here.
Yields. You tell us a little bit about what happened and if this is going to be published.
Yeah. Well, it hasn't been turned around exactly, but at least the research shows it is possible to turn it around. The work that I was referring to with the integrated systems management models is now submitted to Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. A bunch of us are participating in that. But I think the real challenge there, the real problem is, you can see how to do it by really careful management, by knowledge-intensive management. It's possible to imagine best practices that could be suggested for different parts of China, but how to get it to actually happen, as you know, is the big challenge. If fertilizers are subsidized, and they are, ratcheting back on that, but how to get the more, how to take all of those hundreds of thousands of farmers and allow them to be able to use those best management practices is the challenge to me. I think they're thinking that China's a top-down country and we can just say make it happen. My own sense is that there probably has to be some kind of building of communities and associations of farmers that will work on it together. And so there's big potential for huge changes right now in how agriculture is carried out in China. It's also driven, of course, by other economic factors. A lot of those farmers who farm those small plots of land want to be working someplace else most of the year. They don't want to be applying fertilizer in small amounts, time to crop requirements. So, you know, how is it going to work? But it's exciting that there's a clear path. I mean, at least there's a clear technology, a clear approach to making it happen. Getting the path right is the next challenge. Oh, yes.
I didn't see a citation of the work where you went across this, you went through understanding how information and influence actually moved.
Right, yeah. It's in press in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences right now. It's McCullough and Mattson, and I could be happy to send you a paper. We also just are publishing a book that brings together all of these different pieces and many, many more, especially on the water resources side, so that'll be coming along eventually. But the knowledge system stuff I'd be happy to share if you want to give me your card. And hopefully it will show up in PNAS at some time. Okay, thank you.
All right. As a token of our appreciation, Pamela, we have a plaque that reads, "The Crop Science Society of America recognizes Pamela A. Mattson as a distinguished scholar presenting the 2010 Betty Klepper Endowed Lectureship funded through the Agronomic Science Foundation." Thank you so much.
Thank you.